Okay, so we're going to be entering into a section in an argument category of analogy. Okay, and this argument from design is dependent from the first cause argument. Okay, so we're not going to seek to argue that God exists anymore. We're going to argue that the first cause was an intelligent being. Okay, so we're arguing about the cause now. At this point, we have moved past existence. And you could even at this point assume we've concluded that it's reasonable to believe God exists. It's reasonable to believe there's a first cause. Now we're going to argue about what is that first cause like. Okay? And so this involves an inductive reference to the specific arrangement, to fill in your blank there, arrangement of parts within an object, which suggests an intention behind the specific design. The argument appeals to the idea that complex machines are intelligent beings to serve a specific purpose. You might want to circle specific purpose. That's going to be a key. Similarly, it is reasonable to think that the living organisms which have a higher degree of complexity would be designed by an intelligent being for a purpose as well. So the cause, we are going to get a sense that the cause is intelligent. And like I said, we're not going to be establishing existence, but we're looking at the cause itself. Okay, so the watch and the watchmaker. What are some conclusions that you, after reading this, what are conclusions that you made about the cause or the idea that there is a cause? And what can we know about this cause? Is that too vague a question?
You mean about the maker?
That, right.
That there was a cause, or that there's no doubt there is a cause?
Well, that there no doubt is a cause, but what are we starting to gather about a cause or a maker, even based on this analogy, the watch and the watchmaker?
The maker has power, and that goes all the way to seven, where he put those things together to work, and they work because he put those things together.
Okay. And notice what she said. He put those things together. What does that imply? There's a he. And then he has intention.
Intelligent designer.
He's intelligent. He has a purpose. Okay? And so these are some of the things that we start to gather that even from the simple analogy, we identify that whoever made the watch, there is a someone who made the watch. That person is intelligent. That person or watchmaker had an intention for this watch, and it was going to serve a purpose. Okay? And so these type of things are what move us into this next frame of the argument of analogy. Okay? Such an analogy can also be made another way. Okay? So we've talked about the watch and the watchmaker. Are there any questions about the watch and the watchmaker? Or any other observations you have about that? Yes, sir.
Well, I think it's interesting he wrote this before he even knew the complexity of a cell. So a cell is so much more complex than a watch. And to think that, I mean, any atheist would think it would be absurd that that watch came by chance. So to think that a cell came by chance is even more absurd. So I think it's a very powerful argument.
And something that Behe suggested, he said it's not just out of convenience that we call these things what we call them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he's talking about the flagellum and the outboard motor.
Yeah.
He's like a U-joint, a drive shaft, water coolant. He's talking about all these things, and he said, it's not just handy that we can call these things those things, but these are the purposes they serve. There is a U-joint. There is a drive shaft. There is a water coolant system. There's a fuel that comes from the acid within, you know, the area. I mean, it's just amazing that a scientist would never say that the watch just gathered parts over centuries and billions of years. But they'll say that about the way DNA is composed and the different working organisms that are involved in that process. And so things which exist in the world can possess the distinct characteristics of the following three things. And this is key to the argument of analogy. Complexity is the first thing. Utility is the second thing. And meaning is the third thing. So complexity, utility, and meaning. Now these properties could be innate or they may be imputed, but these properties, when we stumble upon them, what we're going to identify that if a watch or a computer or something else is consisting of these three characteristics, and we automatically assume a designer, if these same three characteristics are found in nature, why do we not assume a designer? Okay? And so first of all, we need to identify what do we mean by complexity? What do we mean by complexity, you guys suppose?
Several parts.
Okay, so there's one part, but there's multiple parts.
With a specific function in each part and specific arrangement.
Okay, and that actually kind of, I think, goes into utility when we're talking about specific function. If it bears utility, it serves a purpose. It has
the order is, I think, Dr. Lipke's name.
Okay.
The order is specific.
So there's a specific order to the complex parts, okay? And so then we have utility, meaning it serves a purpose, and each part, each complex part serves a complex purpose, okay? And then the third thing, there's meaning behind it. Let's give some examples. Under complexity there, I don't know what you have in your notes. Okay, you have the watch. We have a computer, a seed, a cell, or an eye. And so all of these have complexity. They have multiple parts, and each part functioning in its own arena serves a purpose for the greater good of the device. Utility, we have the watch, a car, or the wheel, a tree. What is some utility that a tree serves?
Shade, oxygen.
Fuel. Did you say food? Okay.
Beetles.
Okay. And then you have the sun under utility, and you have the heart serves a purpose. And then you have within meaning the watch. Obviously, the meaning for the watch is time. A sentence is a message. A seed, the genetic code, and we talked about DNA and all of the different things there and the parts that are intricately working together, and they're producing a message, and that's your genetic code, and that's eventually manifesting in what you look like. Okay. And so take an example here, the letters L-E-I-B-O-U-Y-O. Okay. Now these letters possess no meaning, but rearranged into a different order, they spell I love you. Suddenly they possess meaning. Okay? And so we have to look that it's not just the collection, a simple collection of these parts, but it's a specific collection that produces a message that has meaning. They each bear, there's complexity, there's utility, and there's also meaning in the arrangement of these letters themselves. Now you wouldn't think if you came across on the beach and you saw I love you written on the beach, you wouldn't think, wow, the tide randomly washed up and etched these letters into the... That's just crazy.
You know what, Chad? I had an experience like that, though. One day in October in about 2004, I walked out of my house to start a car, and the frost on my car was so intricately designed in circles that I was like, I know nobody could put down frost on my car like that, but I have never seen that sort of order in the frost.
Well, and it begs the question that if we identify order like that elsewhere, why wouldn't you appeal to the maybe God in the way that He designed water molecules and how they freeze? And
I did somehow, you know, somehow God did that, but I don't know exactly how that works.
It's part of that complexity issue,
right?
That we don't. No.
And one of the things that I've been talking to the theology students about in high school is this idea that God does what He does because God is who He is. And that, like I said, we did this Create Your World project. I don't know if I told you guys about this. And I had them, I said, you have the power to create ex nihilo. You have the power of God to create out of nothing. And you can create your own world. Go. So for about a week, they wrote papers creating their own world. Some of them had a world where everyone had a roller coaster in their backyard. Your daughters had a roller coaster in their backyard. And everyone had three roller coasters, fast, medium, and slow. And they could go anywhere in the world, and it was free. And so it just kept unfolding more and more about this roller coaster world. Another individual had a world that everyone had their own carnival, No one ever got tired, so there was no reason to sleep, and you could have as much fun as you possibly wanted. And there was also no jealousy. No one was jealous of the other person's carnival. And different things like one had a every day was National Shopping Day. there was no such thing as money. Everyone worked at what they loved to do, and it, somehow the world worked, and everyone enjoyed working, and everything was free, and there's no concept of money or anything like that, and it was a happy world. So one had a world that was literally shaped and had, I think, like a star, like a three-dimensional star, and on each kind of one of these points of the star, it was a different climate year-round, that same climate. And so you could travel to different parts of the star, and it wasn't that hard to get around, and you could be in a different climate. And another person's world was a sci-fi space trilogy kind of world, where there was planets being destroyed and created and different things like that. Another one, there was a world where trees were have personalities and could uproot and walk, similar to Lord of the Rings. And it was interesting, as they wrote these worlds, these stories, I took them, and no one knew who wrote what story, and I would read them. I would read the story and the description of their world, and they would have to guess who wrote each world. And they were able to guess, each one, who wrote the different world, because they could identify that they bared characteristics of their creator. They had a sense, and they felt, and they just exuded the personality of that of the creator of that world. And so then we drew the conclusion, and they quickly went there with me, that this world also, it bears a fingerprint. It can't help but exude the personality of its creator. The fingerprints of God are everywhere, in the frost on your windshield, whether it's in the physical creation or it's in the personalities of the creation itself. We can't help but bear the personalities of the world that God created. And so it was just interesting that there is that general revelation that the creation and the heavens, they bear his fingerprint, and they can't help it because he is who he is, and so therefore he does what he does. Okay, and so we have this idea of these letters forming on the beach. We would know, and we wouldn't guess that they were by random placement of the tide or anything like that, but they were put there by somebody and arranged those letters with the complexity of the sentence, the utility of using the letters to communicate the meaning or the message. So why do we now know that the letter has not been arranged by chance, but due to the intent of an intelligent agent? The intent of an intelligent agent. Ultimately, the meaning for those letters comes from intelligence and nowhere else. So we would have to identify the watch was created by something with intelligence. So when we find complexity, utility, and meaning existing in something within creation, the natural conclusion has to be, since everything else in our experience that bears these three characteristics, that thing in nature must also come from intelligence. If we're going to follow the evidence and follow the way things generally tend to work, then we would have to conclude, if we find these things in nature, they come from intelligence. Okay? Like when Dave Newell's talking about flying, and he sees that reservoir where the water had dropped. There was a perfect white line around there. Okay? To identify that as just a fluke, when he said when he's flying, his eye is drawn to anything that has order or has meaning or has intention. He knows that's man-made and that's a possible place to land. And when his eye is just drawn to this white line on the reservoir wall, he identifies, he's like, wow, that's crazy, that's in nature. But to realize that too comes from intelligence. The way that water settles, those type of things, come from an intelligent design. It's kind of exciting. Any thoughts so far? Yeah.
So how does Dawkins even, what's his strong enough argument about this?
Well, it comes back to a lot of the same stuff, with the idea that given enough time, that means there's enough chances for events unfolding this way. And so things that appear designed aren't necessarily designed. It's basically, that's what I said, when he writes The Blind Watchmaker, he just simply says there's a intricate factory that has evolved in necessary conditions that would produce things like this, like the watch. And the funny thing is I was just reading, I'm continuing to read What's So Great About Christianity by Dinesh D'Souza. Mm-hmm. And he takes Dawkins on this point about how William Paley was right. Because Dawkins appeals to, well, the watch wasn't designed. It was a product of a very intricate, elaborate, gigantic, time-filled factory that could make something that's complex, that has utility, that has meaning. And all D'Souza says, well, then who made the factory? If there's a watch that's produced by this intricate factory, and you're going to try to explain away that the fact that the watch is designed, you've just created something more intricate, more complex, more meaning of intelligence to create the watch, because that appeals even more to our experience that we've never experienced a factory that came about by chance. It's always created and has intelligence and multiple intelligences behind it. So he just removes it in one step.
So their answer still is time, right?
Time.
Keep on pushing. Yeah,
they just inject more time.
Now we're a trillion years old.
So
if you're talking complex, there isn't, at least in my opinion, anything more complex than the human body, because I mean it. Every minor detail works on the other thing, and it's very fragile and yet really resilient, and all of those things. If you start breaking down every little thing from the top all the way down and look at the DNA, one strand out of place and it's all mm-hmm. a complete mess, and yet it's
yeah.
all perfect. It all works in perfect
yeah.
complexity together.
Yeah, we went to a Chris Tomlin worship event last year, and Lou Giglio was speaking there, and he was talking about the magnificence of God, and that the largest star we can identify is Canis Majora. And to get an idea of how large this star is, and Canis Majora means
big dog.
My lap speaker's in the back there. And so he says, basically, to get a idea of the scale, it would take, if the Earth was the size of a golf ball, it would take filling the state of Texas 2 feet deep with golf balls to fill Canis Majora with Earths. It's a big star. It's huge. And yet, he looked at it and he said, if you took DNA, what did he say? He said, if you took a human strand of DNA, you could wrap it around, I think, the Earth, like, I don't know how many times. But to the smallest detail, to the largest detail, God is magnificent in that in just simply moving effortlessly, he creates Canis Majora. But he also is able to see the smallest, most minute detail within DNA or the bacterial flagellum. I mean, it's pretty amazing that God spans, that size is not an issue with God. Okay. Any other ideas or thoughts about what we've talked about so far? Any questions?
Okay.
Yes?
Could I read something real quick?
Uh-huh.
Page?
Yeah.
I just grabbed this off the shelf this morning. This book is called The Collapse of Evolution.
Make sure to speak loudly so our listeners at home.
Yeah, I don't really want me on tape. there's a chapter in here on math, and so the numbers will bore you. I'm used to that because I teach it. But just in reference to time, he says, let's consider the chance development of a very simple system composed of only 200 integrated parts. Simple compared with living systems. The probability of forming such an ordered system is 1 in 200 factorial. And then that's a number that's a paragraph long. He lists it out. This colossal number can be written more simply as approximately 10 to the 375th. Thus, there's only one chance, 10 to the 375th, of selecting the proper arrangement for a 200-part integrated system on the first trial. But what if we keep on trying different combinations over and over again? Won't we eventually achieve the desired result? Well, to begin with, there are only 10 to the 80th electrons in the universe. And he references that. I don't know exactly how he got his number. He went out and counted. But assuming this to be the maximum number of parts available to work with, only 1 times 10 to the 80th, blah, blah, blah. Groups of 200 parts each could be formed at any one given time. But we have to form 10 to the 375th such groups to be certain of getting the correct one. Assuming that none of the first trial groups work, let's continue trying over and over again. at a generous rate of 1 billion trials per second. Furthermore, to give the evolutionists every possible advantage, let's keep on trying for a period of 30 billion years, since this is the presumed age of the universe. But even granting such liberal concessions, we find that the maximum number of trial combinations which could be attempted is still only 5 times 10 to the 104th, far short of the needed 10 to the 375th trial combinations required for success. And so even after all this, the chance that one of these attempts would yield the desired result of a 200-part system is only 1 out of 2 times 10 to the 270th. Simply stated, the chance that a system composed of 200 integrated parts could develop by mere chance is, for all practical purposes, non-existent. And then he keeps going. I mean, he's just going with the argument of even given enough time.
Right.
Time doesn't help.
Time doesn't help the probability factor. Mm-hmm. And what's their response to that?
More time.
It doesn't matter because we're here.
We're here.
It doesn't matter how improbable it was. We're here, so let's move on. All right. Yes, sir.
If I mean the people that actually believe in evolution, you know, of course we evolved from the slime in the pond and,
right.
and then into the monkeys and the monkeys. I mean, why can't they see that? Why are the monkeys now not evolving? I mean, why aren't they evolving to a higher? I mean, if that's where they say we started, why are they at a stalemate? I mean.
Well, and also you make a great point, and to add to it, that if evolution is the weaker dying off, why are there monkeys at all? Why aren't they gone? Obviously, we are the evolved state, and so that would have died off because it wouldn't have been as productive. Why are there monkeys at all?
Because we're so evolved that we're kind to the monkeys. That's the only
thing. Well, I mean, we're finding monkeys in places we didn't know there were monkeys. So they're still existing.
Yeah, but why haven't we evolved to another stage?
Yeah.
Well, their argument is that we are.
They are. Oh, that's okay. Not your argument. Way more evolved than you are, you know.
They say we are.
Well, and there's the quantum physics or quantum mechanics group is saying that we are evolving into a state of non-matter.
But nobody can live long enough to get witness or experience the change because of time.
So, no, you can bring a great point.
To a state of non-matter, explain it.
Okay. Anyone else know about quantum mechanics or quantum physics here? Okay. It's basically the idea, Jeff, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that matter, they've never really been able to pinpoint exactly what matter is. They used to think that, like, matter or an atom was this little ball of substance. But now they've recognized that matter is electrons. Okay, it's just electrons, protons, neutrons, you know, traveling about. And so there's no such thing as a physical little ball that composes all of creation or all the stuff that we know is to be physical. And so what these quantum mechanics, quantum physics people say is that if we can start to travel down that path as to what is the energy energy that composes everything and that we're all composed of the same energy, it's going to bring us into a state of metaphysics, basically, beyond the physical realm of understanding how we interact and affect each other non-physically instead of physically. And so the simple sensation of me pushing against this table, I'm not actually touching a thing. I'm touching energy. I'm touching electrons and neutrons. I mean,
the whole thing of like when we die, our energy then
is dispersed.
It's dispersed into the universe.
Right.
We are one
of
the things.
We are one.
Would you offer anything? I'm not a quantum physicist, so I...
Yeah, I guess all I would say, you know, and it's probably along that line, is that after discovering the proton, neutron, electron, I thought, well, we're at the end, but now there's some 200 plus further subatomic particles, and there's matter and antimatter, and so mm-hmm. it's getting more and more complex, and I'm guessing that's what's led them down that line of argument.
And there was I wrote on the chairlift last year with some guy from University of Scotland. He was getting his PhD. And he was into quantum mechanics, quantum physics, and stuff like that. And I think he brought up a famous argument that it's the cat in the box. And it's basically, we, if there's a cat in a box that we can't see into, and there's some radioactive material in there as well, we don't know if the cat is dead or alive because we can't see it. And so it's neither in a state of dead or alive. It's because we don't know. I mean, is that the argument? That's what he told me. And so he was arguing against absolute truth, that there's no way to there's no such thing as absolute truth, because that example right there knows. And I said, well, the cat's either dead or alive, whether we can see it or not, doesn't change. It's either still breathing or it's not breathing. And he goes, well, you can't know. So it's neither. And it's like, no, just because I don't know doesn't mean God doesn't know. You
well,
know?
Just because
maybe that was like the hillbilly answer, but...
there are many things in the universe that we don't know and understand. Doesn't mean they don't exist. I still don't know how that watch was made, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So the argument that if you don't know...
It's like the stars or the planets that they're continually finding. Well, we didn't know that they were there, but they were there.
Right.
They did exist. But now we're like, oh yeah, it exists.
No, I mean, yeah. It.
You know what all this says to me? Is that there, that Satan is incredibly powerful to have duped so many people through the education system, because there is no other way a rational thinking person could believe this world occurred by chance, unless they had totally been duped for about 12 years.
So that would, to go back to the idea of what's the next state of evolution, it's somewhere, they're giving their answer somewhere in the area of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, and it's going to a spiritual level or a non-physical level. So I don't know what that means, but... another, just a quick point of reference to, you're talking about the education system, just a point of awareness that this past week, the state of a Court of Appeals in the state of California legislated from the bench, and they, in one court case, there was a family that was homeschooling their kids, and the decision was by the court, and it was handed down that this had to be true of all homeschooling situations in the state of California, that you had to have a state-certified teaching certificate if you were going to homeschool your children. And it was up through elementary and all the primary stages, and then once it got into high school, you would have to have a state certification to teach every single subject if you were going to homeschool, which basically would say that that's probably, most families aren't going to be able to accomplish that. And so there's approximately, and this is what I heard on the Focus on the Family radio broadcast a couple days ago, there's about 200,000 homeschool students in the state of California. About 200 million?
No.
2 million?
2 million.
In the United States, something like that? That's a similar number.
Yeah.
And so, basically, it's just interesting that the grasp and the desire to control, because they felt the parents were abusive to the children, and I don't know the circumstances, and if it was an abusive situation, obviously it needed to be stopped, but... I was talking with Brad Benson last night at dinner, and he said, so how is that going to change the fact that the kids might get abused if they're in public school for during the day and then come home? How does that change anything?
I think it just gives society a better chance to take kids out of homeschooling. And if they have a religious background and they're being taught about God, and they take them out of that environment, then and I think that's what's happening. I mean, it's not, you know, these kids are being abused. It's like they're saying, well, you know,
teaching them about God is the abuse.
We're teaching these people, the parents are teaching their kids about the right way to be, and they're teaching them one thing about God, but that's wrong. We need to teach them about evolution and the ways of the world, and let them make their own decisions.
Right.
And well, so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think their theory is that it's abusive to impose your beliefs on your children. But that is a ludicrous argument, because if you went into an atheist home, I'm fairly certain that most of those parents raising their kids impose their beliefs on their children, because they tell them, you will do this, you won't do that, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, what happens in the public school? They're
just
imposing their beliefs, indoctrinated. So, Yeah, it didn't mean it's a
so that's not the law that was passed, or
it was a court decision that was made in the Court of Appeals in the state of California, and I think
Court of Appeals or
the Court of Appeals.
They're going to try to appeal it.
Yeah, what was the word? It wasn't appeal.
It was they were going to try to
depublish
the decision, which would make it not
applicable to
everyone. It would just be applicable to that family.
That case.
If there's enough, but it's really up to the judges to decide that.
Oh, there's going
to
be an outrage.
No, I know.
I mean, through every home.
Well, it's interesting too, and I'm paraphrasing James Dobson, who was paraphrasing Hitler. But he basically said, it doesn't matter if we get the parents or the adults, we already have the children. Mm-hmm. And so basically, it's an attempt, it seems, for the government or the secular school system to absorb more power and to have the kids in their system, and they're going to produce in 12 years people with their ideologies. So.
9 News had a poll running yesterday based on that decision about what should happen in Colorado.
Yeah.
The results were pretty much neck and neck, yes and no. When I looked,
they were pretty much.
I was surprised at how many no's there were. I was surprised to see it was like 302 to 277 when I looked yesterday afternoon at the results.
Oh no, it was way. When I looked, it was like 4,000 to 1,000.
Was that 4,000? I looked yesterday afternoon.
Should
have to be credentialed to
And it was 4,000 no to 1,000 yes. So I'm sure they got the homeschoolers all.
Exactly.
Yeah, go to 9 News and push the button.
Push the button.
Yeah, it's about halfway down on the right-hand side of the 9 News. And it's just a yes or no, and it's not a scientific anything.
So you could push it multiple times.
I wondered about that, and then I felt bad for. I was going to.
But
do
you
that.
Could. It's not controlled.
There's
a certain, what's the percentage of error?
Kathy did 200, then she felt guilty.
Yeah.
All right.
Like, should I do that?
Let's move on. We'll keep moving into this analogy. The argument for analogy. Okay, and at the bottom there, so in examining things which are known to be designed by intelligent beings and finding the characteristics of A, complexity, B, utility, and or C, meaning, if intelligence is required as the source of that characteristic, then it is reasonable to think that if anything within nature possessed A, B, and or C, this requires an intelligent source as well. Basically, the existence of these characteristics seems to intelligence. Okay. If they are present in nature, then they must be attributed to a viable source, an intelligent source. And that's something we've been discussing. So by analogy then, the meaning evident in the genetic code of the human body suggests a source similar to that of the watch or a coherent statement. It is therefore reasonable to conclude that the cause is an intelligent agent. As it has been said, perhaps it appears designed because it has been. And the overall evidence for this designer provides sufficient justification. And remember, that takes us back to our Chisholm scale for justification. At what point is someone in a position to affirm or deny? And it's beyond a reasonable doubt. They have to have a point of justification. And like it, we also determine that's subjective and can be different for everybody. But it seems at this point we are in a position to justify, and it's legitimate to understand beyond a reasonable doubt that there is intelligence behind the order, utility, and complexity we find in the universe. Okay. Any questions about that? All right. Turn to your next page. We're going to kind of change gears now. We've been kind of going down the road of establishing God exists. There's a cause or an existence for a cause. The cause is a certain way. And so now we're going to identify that these have all been an effort to support theism. And we're going to talk about what that is in a minute. And now we need to go the next several steps to identify and support Christianity specifically. Okay? Because right now, as we can see here, there's a graph of multiple worldviews, and let's get into that now. In seeking to answer the question, why is there anything at all, we have ventured into the area of philosophy of religion, beginning with worldviews, of which there are four primary perspectives. And Dwayne, if you're listening, I'm going to veer off the path a little bit. I identify these are four great categories. I would add one, and so it would make it five, but then I would also make one less important, so there would still be four. Okay, so what I would do on your right-hand side, write polytheism in there. And we'll look at some examples of religions that fall under polytheism in a minute. And then the panentheism, the one that was at the end there, I would kind of make that a subgroup. I think the four major categories that all worldviews can be broken down into are theism, pantheism, atheism, and polytheism. And so for the type A's out there, you're going to have to get real creative to make it neat and succinct. But I wouldn't cross out panentheism. I would just make it...
Under which one? Would it go under polytheism?
It would probably go under pantheism.
I've never heard of panentheism.
And it's something that is very prevalent at Oregon State University. And so,
really?
And when Duane was developing his curriculum, he was on staff there with Crusade, so that might maybe why it's on the list is pretty prominent. But when we describe it, it may seem more relevant than you think. So, first of all, we have theism, and theism is basically the belief of what?
A God.
A God. You could also put mono in front of that. Monotheism, meaning one God. And right there you have, under the category of theism, Islam, Judaism, deism, Christianity. What's deism? God created the world. He kind of set it spinning, and now it's kind of sitting back with popcorn watching the soap opera unravel. Okay, that it's a impersonal God that does not care about the affairs of its creation, but started things and then is standing back and watching, kind of laissez-faire, hands-off. Okay, pantheism is this idea that... Do you have the list of definitions there? You go. Okay. God is identical with all that exists, and everything makes up a part of God. So God is in everything. God is in the trees. God is in the tables. God's in us. God's in the clouds. God's in everything in the physical world. He's in it all. Okay? And you could identify Native American religions with that. The Great Spirit is a part and it is in all of us, and there's a great harmony. Other animism and Hinduism fall into pantheism. We'll discuss panentheism since it's kind of related. Panentheism is this idea that everything is in God, but God is more than everything. Okay, so I would describe it like this. So this would be everything. And this would be God. So everything that exists is in God, or God is a part and in everything, but God exists beyond everything, if that makes sense. Okay? Pantheism would be simply this. This would be both God and everything. Okay. That makes sense? So everything and God are one and the same. And like the description there says, pluralism is a form of panentheism, or is taken on this idea, because if you've ever heard of the Baha'i faith or Universalist Unitarians, those types of faiths, those would be kind of panentheists. And they take on different forms, but they're basically identifying that all religions are valid expressions of the sacred, is the terminology they use. That all religions, all philosophical bents are just, they're all the same, they're all equally valid, they're just different forms that this sacred truth that's in and about everything, it's just manifested itself in different ways. Problem I have with that, and some analogies they use, that there's a mountain and that all different religions are just different pathways to the top of this mountain, and they're trying to be all inclusive. You guys find any problems with that?
Yeah.
What about the atheists? Atheists don't think the mountain exists. They're not trying to get to the top, and so they're exclusive to atheists who don't have a path. So to atheists that are going to identify, there's no such thing as God, there's no such thing as the non-physical spiritual realm, and they don't believe in it. And so here they have this big mountain, everyone's just climbing a different route to the top. Atheists are standing at the bottom, excluded, because their path, there is no path. And so it's interesting that in trying to be all inclusive, you're still exclusive. Mm-hmm. And you're also exclusive to those people who think that theirs is the exclusive way. It's interesting. Okay, so that's panentheism. Any questions about that?
I have a question. Uh-huh. I'm not sure that you're excluding them. I think that they just choose not to climb.
They just don't want to climb?
We left them on that other, you know, we passed them when we got to the fact that we believed in an intelligent designer. They're still back there. We're over here.
Well, I would say that it's exclusive because you're identifying their understanding as less than yours. Because in talking with Baha'i and Universalist Unitarians, I went to a Universalist Unitarian service in college, and it was interesting because there was Buddhists and Hindus and Christians and Jehovah's Witnesses, and there was just all kinds, and they got up and they would read a common scripture, but they wouldn't tell you where it was from. They would just read a passage, whether it was from a magazine article or it didn't matter where it was from. But it's interesting that there was a certain, not elitism, but there was kind of a, well, atheists, they just aren't here yet. They just haven't arrived yet. And so there was a kind of hierarchy to, well, fundamentalist Christians, they believe in God, but they're not there yet. They haven't opened their minds quite enough to experience the full knowledge. And so there was this, those that had attained universal or pluralism had attained the highest form of understanding there was. Fundamentalists in any other religion were kind of there, but they weren't all the way there. And then atheists were, well, they hadn't even got started yet. And so they were a sub kind of, if that makes sense. So in the sense, yeah, they're not exclusive in that analogy because they're still in the analogy, they're just standing at the bottom of the mountain. But in general practice and attitude, it seemed like there was an exclusive nature because they hadn't, even towards me, I just hadn't been fully enlightened yet.
It's kind of an intellectual exclusiveness. Actually, Baha'i really thrives usually around college campuses.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And there were several of them on our campus.
Yeah, and a lot of people.
And they're going to say different prophets or manifestations of the truth have occurred in Jesus, Muhammad, all of these prophets of different religions. They've all just, that's when truth has manifested itself, and we just need to grab onto snippets. And there's also a sense that you just need to pick whatever line or practice or religion you're most comfortable with and be true to that, and you're all right for the afterlife as far as that's concerned. Just pick a path and stick with it and be true to that and sincere to it, and you'll be all right. So, okay. And then any other questions about that?
What's an agnostic?
It's interesting. An agnostic, in theory, is somebody who is not decided. They're undecided. So they could see there's good arguments for God's existence, but they can also see there's good arguments for God not existing. So they're kind of on the fence as far as, does God exist or not? Is Christianity true? Is it not? But they practice atheism. They're atheists by practice because they, even though they're not sure, they assume God, and they live their life as though God doesn't exist, rather than that he does. And so
I've had teenagers tell me, I'm an agnostic, I don't believe in God. Well, then they're atheists. They're practicing atheists.
Yeah. I would say agnostics are simply atheists that have commitment problems. They just fear commitment.
My sister's an agnostic.
Can't prove it one way or the other, so.
But it's interesting, they all default to God. I'm going to live my life as though he doesn't exist. Absolutely. Even though I'm not sure,
right.
They practice one of the two.
Her attitude, she'll find out when she dies.
Yeah.
That's her attitude.
And so they live like atheists, but they, in theory and intellectually, like this idea that they're almost above the fray, and they haven't decided, and they're almost intellectually superior because they see validity to both sides, therefore they can claim the intelligence of both sides. But they live like atheists. So that's where I would put them, is under atheism. And so atheism is the idea that there is no God. Atheism. And so that's naturalism, relativism. A description of relativism that I like came from a guy named Greg Kokel, who's a president and founder of a ministry called Stand to Reason. And he wrote a book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. It's a great way to express what relativism is. So, Any questions about these? Under polytheism, what are some examples of polytheism? And polytheism is what?
Many
gods. There are many gods, or the belief that multiple gods exist.
Buddhism.
And Buddhism is an interesting one because it can fall under theism, pantheism, atheism, panentheism, and polytheism. Just depends on the garden variety that you come across. But there are Buddhists in every single camp there. There's, and a popular thing these days too is Catholic Buddhists. It's fascinating because they're going back to this kind of monastic idea and this idea of casting off all the distractions and complexities of life and simplifying into a meditation, kind of finding your true self. And so they like to practice a lot of Zen stuff, but still like kind of the traditions and they're attracted to Catholicism and some of the practices there. I met several of those in college as well, these Catholic Buddhists. It's fascinating. What are some other examples of polytheism, the idea that there are many gods?
What about the Native
ancient
Americans?
Greeks?
Native Americans, definitely. Greeks, Egyptians.
The Mormons?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought it up because a lot of people would categorize them because they're kind of like Christians, so they must be kind of theistic. And they would argue that they're monotheistic, but then they would also argue that they're not, which is also kind of interesting. But they are polytheistic, and why would you say that, Beth?
Because part of their theology is that they're aspiring to be gods.
Uh-huh.
Through expanding their family. Is that true?
Well, and it's this idea that, and I've heard it described in many ways, but basically the men in Mormonism have the potential to be like Jesus,
mm-hmm.
who also was a man who lived as a good Mormon and became God of this planet. And so we too, as men, have the potential to become gods of other planets if we...
It's more planets, right? Through expanding the family, I think you
right.
get more planets. And if you're God of that planet, there must be...
And you can also, and that's polygamy became popular, but now is not popular by way of the church, but there's different camps around the country and around the world that still practice polygamy. But the idea of expanding family and then also the purpose of that is women have the potential that upon death you could be selected by your husband to help populate these new planets. And so you could be eternally pregnant if that's what you're saying. And I know Shannon wouldn't like that. So yeah, there's a lot of things that get into it. This idea that Jesus and Satan were spirit brothers and but the basic gist of it is that God the Father and God the Son are completely separate entities. And there's two gods there. God the Spirit is also a separate entity. So there becomes three gods. And then there's Mormons that have gone on and are gods of other planets. So they're an increasing number of gods. So they are very polytheistic in their theology. Well, they would claim to be just like us. They would claim to be Christians, actually. So any other polytheistic? Christians were accused of polytheism because of the triune God. For many years, I think up through like Constantine, the 300s, they were accused of all kinds of different incest, and because they would greet each other with a brotherly kiss, different things like that. Polytheism, all kinds of stuff. So they were also accused of being atheists. Christians were the first 300 years because they denied the emperor as being a god, so therefore they didn't believe in God, and they were killed as atheists. Fascinating, too. Anyway, so it's important to know what we are, and it's important to know what we are not. It's also important to know how do we identify these worldviews when we come across them, whether it's in movies, whether it's in books, magazines, radio, in the supermarket. It doesn't matter, but you're going to, every single person, that's the catch, everyone has a worldview. And so let's define worldview as defined as a framework through which we understand existence. A framework through which we understand existence. Everyone has a framework through which they understand existence. Similar to the agnostic, they may have a theoretical framework that they like to talk about and espouse, but they live by a certain framework. Everyone lives by a framework through which they understand existence. Therefore, they have a worldview, a way they see the world, a lens. When I used to play baseball, we had these Oakley M frames. Do you guys remember those? Really cool kind of sunglasses. And we'd have different lenses we could put in there depending on the weather. So if it was a real cloudy day, we would all put on our yellow lenses so that we could see the white ball a lot easier. And it would actually kind of make the entire day seem sunny and bright. And so it was interesting that depending on the lens, it could change the way that you literally saw the world. You saw the physical world around you. It's sunny. Things were clear. Anyone who has a prescription lens, until you wear that prescription, things seem foggy, whether they're close up or far away. But your image of reality is distorted until you have the right lens. And so that is similar to a worldview. Our worldview is the lens through which we see the world, and it colors the way we see everything. And so until we have the right prescription of the right framework, the right lens, we will see reality in a distorted way. And so what we'll argue here is that Christianity is the correct lens. Every reality will be distorted until you see it through a complete biblical worldview. So, okay. Everyone has a perception of the way things actually are, so we all have a worldview, but what we should be interested in is the worldview offering the best explanation of reality. Okay, the initial questions that begin forming a worldview are two. First one is, what is the nature of God? What is the nature of God? Now, this question entails answering, is there a God? It also entails, what is God like? Because if you ask somebody, what's the nature of God, and they don't believe in God, they're going to say, well, I don't believe God exists. If you ask them, what is the nature of God, and they believe in God, but they're a Buddhist, they're going to tell you, God exists, and this is what he exists like. And so this question, what is the nature of God, is going to be a gateway into understanding and exposing what someone thinks. I was walking in a park in Pennsylvania with Worldview, and we were out doing our witnessing, and I came across a guy, and he was sitting there eating a Subway sandwich, and as he was sitting there under this tree, I just came up to him and said, hey, how you doing today? He goes, oh, I'm all right. I said, I'm with a group, and we're just out asking some philosophical questions of people, and you look like you're having a peaceful afternoon eating your lunch. Would you be up for just a fun philosophical? And he's like, yeah, man, I love talking about that stuff. Okay, cool. I said, what do you believe the nature of God is? And he goes, oh, man, that's a cool question. Well, I think that God's in everything. He's everywhere. He's in you. He's in me. And so right away, I can conclude what? What is his worldview?
Pantheist.
He's a pantheist, okay? And so that kind of helps me understand where he's coming from. And so I had some questions I had for pantheists that I had kind of thought of. And I said, so you're saying God is in me, so I'm God. He goes, yeah. I said, you're God. He goes, yeah. I said, so the sandwich you're eating is God? He's like, yeah. So you're telling me right now God is eating himself because you're eating that sandwich. And he's like, yeah, I mean, it's not exactly like you make it sound, but I guess, sure. And I was like, okay. I said, so when people get in a fight, if I were to just come out and pop you in the mouth right now, well, I'm not going to. And he's like, okay, man. But if in theory, you're telling me that God is beating himself up or itself up. And he said, I guess you could say that. And I said, so when countries go to war, God is in everything and people are dying. God is killing himself? And he's like, well, I guess if you want to put it that way. I said, well, I don't want to, but you're kind of making me. And so we have to think through when we identify these worldviews, we got to think through what are the questions then that follow. And so one of the next primary question, what is the nature of man?
We have a question, which I should probably know, but of all of these groups of religions, how many of them believe in the opposite of God, which is Satan or evil?
Oh, that they both exist?
Yes.
I would say probably all of them identify evil as a contrary force, except for atheism.
Because even in... Atheists wouldn't have just gone right to that. Well, maybe you're not God, maybe you're evil.
Well, pantheists would identify a yin-yang, that there's a balance and equality. And so if there's a good, there has to be a bad in order to understand the good. And that kind of happens. their pluralism. They identify evil coming from just people that are unenlightened or they just lack understanding and clarity. And so the next question though, what is the nature of man, is going to help even more kind of define what someone's thinking, specifically within a theistic worldview. If you ask somebody, what do you think the nature of God is, or what's the nature of God, and they answer, well, I think there's one God. And so you're identifying, okay, they're theistic. And then this next question, what is the nature of man then? And they're going to say, well, what do you mean? And you say, well, is man good when they're born? Are humans good and then turn bad? Or are they born bad? And, you know, how do you explain that? And if they identify humans are born good, and then it's society that makes them bad, well, then they're not from a Christian worldview. They're from a different worldview. And it's interesting because if you look at Judaism, Islam, and even deism, they're going to identify the nature of man as sometimes partially good, partially bad, or sometimes or entirely good. But these, as a whole and as a theology, won't identify the nature of man as good. I mean, as bad. Only Christians will. So even in Judaism, there's this idea that, yes, we're sinful, but we still have an opportunity and almost an obligation to do good things to earn merit with God. It's a works-based theology. Islam is the same way. Islam is this idea that we are born good, and there's bad influences in society that are going to draw us away from the good. But we have to do things and practice certain things in order to earn merit with God. But we have the ability to do that. They may say to your face, no, man is bad. But as soon as they tell you that we can earn favor with God, they are telling you basically, without saying it, that we have the potential to be good if we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Christianity is the only one that's going to tell you we are completely, totally sinful at birth. Society has nothing to do with it. We compose society, therefore society is evil because we are inherently evil. And it's not until the grace of God, by the unmerited favor of Jesus Christ and His blood, that elevates us even into the category of loving and worshiping a holy God. And so Christianity's identifying, they're the only ones that identify the idea that man is by nature completely sinful at birth. So that's going to help us narrow down a little bit more. Any questions? Usually there's some questions about this. Yeah.
Well, and so how do you then give me the explanation if I ask you as one of these other people, then what happens? You're telling me that if man is inherently bad from birth and this baby is born and he lives for a week and he dies, what happens?
Mm-hmm. I wish I was Hank Camgraff at this point. My words. There's a couple of different ways to approach this. There's one in a philosophical sense that's called middle knowledge, that God has middle knowledge. He has perfect knowledge of all the decisions that could potentially be made. And so they would appeal to this idea that because of God's middle knowledge, He would know, had this child grown up, how they would have decided if given the chance. There's also this idea, and this comes from, I think, Judaism, this idea of the age of accountability, that until a certain age, a child's not accountable for their behavior. But remember, they're sinful by nature. And so it's a tough one because usually it's fueled by emotion more than anything. And I can identify, I think that's a legitimate emotion to feel, that if you have a loved one that's a baby that has passed away, that's a hard question. It's hard to identify, is God going to allow that person to go to hell, that baby, that really had no chance to fend for themselves? But then if we go back to the idea that, is it up to us in the first place? Is our understanding of God and our being born again, is that a product of our own discernment, our own intelligence, our own comprehension? Or is it because the Spirit enables us to understand? That I think it's one of those, let's ask God when we get there type of things. I don't know. Scripture doesn't give a slam dunk answer to that. I think it comes from a collection of your theological ground as to how that is answered. So that's a tough one. I think if I was asked that question by a non-believer, or someone from another worldview, I would try to identify what is their true barrier to what's behind the question. Is that what's going to hinder them from accepting the gospel of Christ? And that's their big hang-up, that Christians say babies go to hell or babies go to heaven, or I don't know. I'm going to try to find a deeper issue there than just that, because I think there's more to it than that. And identify, is there an emotional appeal because they had an experience? They have a friend, a relative, their own child died early, and so they want to know where that is. I had a friend in college who, his emotional hang-up to Christianity was his father was an atheist and passed away. He was a devout atheist. And he knew that by accepting the Christian understanding of the afterlife, he was going to have to accept that his dad was in hell. And so, really, that was the issue, that there was an emotional issue dealing with not wanting his dad to be in a place that didn't seem appealing. And so I think I would try to identify a deeper issue, but I'm certainly not a scholar to the point that I could answer that with absolute certainty, and so I would have to look into it a little bit more. But yeah, these are, I would give them the different options that are out there. Anyone else have an explanation for that? That if we are sinful by nature, we are born sinful, we don't become sinful, what happens if there's a miscarriage? What happens in the event of a baby dying at 2 years old? I mean, this is a very sensitive area. And it's one that I don't have the slam dunk answer for you, because there's no passage of scripture that I've found that says this is exactly what happens.
The only scripture that comes to my mind is when the little children were coming to Jesus, and the apostles wanted them to not do that. And he said, do not hinder the little children from coming to me, for heaven is filled with such as these.
Mm-hmm. And also David's child that died, there's indication that David at least believed that that child was going to heaven. Mm-hmm. And I've heard, and I've been taught that that is proof of the age of accountability sort of argument. But I think the more rational one is the middle knowledge. Because if certain people are the elect, and they haven't made that age of accountability yet, well, then they go, if they're elected.
So it really appeals to your theological background, I think, on this one. So
ultimately, I think it's up to God. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be my answer, is that He is the Creator. He's the one that created that life in the first place. And it's up to Him, and He's just, and He's good.
And I think, too, if someone asks that question, you don't want to kind of dismiss the question. You want to give it a legitimate response and be honest about it, but you want to steer it back to them. Okay, regardless of, right now, a baby, yes or no, where are you at? Because the person asking the question obviously has the intelligence to ask the question, and so really it's about where are they at, right, at that point. And so to give them an honest answer, whether you know or you don't know, or you have a strong conviction about it, but then to steer it back to, okay, the real question is where are you at with all this stuff? And if you were to die today, where would you go, type of thing? Okay? Any other questions about the nature of man question? Okay. So in order to form a consistent worldview, the answers to the initial questions will determine the answers to the essential questions that follow. And so you guys have that table there. And so the essential questions of how did we come to exist at all? What is the purpose of life? What constitutes a human being? How can we determine right and wrong? What happens after death? As you can see, these different worldviews are going to answer in different ways. And it's going to originally stem from their previous questions. So, justification for the theistic worldview has been given. Okay, we've identified that there's a reason to believe in one God, creating intelligently this universe that we have. If any theistic religion is true, it is necessary that theism is true. So the worldview provides the basis for the religions which follow from it. Each religion contains additional propositions which must be examined. And so that's what we're looking at. Now we've concluded that there's beyond a reasonable doubt, or there's strong reason to believe theism is an accurate worldview. And so what that does is that gives some legitimacy to the religions that are theistic. But like the notes say, there's this idea that each of them carry their own propositions that are either right or wrong. And so we have to identify those. So what we're going to be going into is, in order to establish the Christian worldview, which includes theism, there must be justification to believe Christianity as well. So we have to now go into specifically Christianity as a worldview and as a religion. Is it valid? What qualifies as proof? And this is the big question. Can you prove it? Proof is often thought to be absolute certainty. Or the elimination of all other possibilities. So proof is often thought to be absolute certainty or the elimination of all other possibilities. Which that gets a little interesting, because what can't be proven?
Atheism, there is no God.
Okay.
Unless you've checked everything.
God.
Right? Unless you've gone to every corner of the universe, right?
God.
God can't be proven.
Prove God.
Well, what God looks like, maybe. Where God is.
I would put there historical events. I think that brings it down to a little bit more of a conversational level. What can't be proven are historical events. Okay? Kathy, I love the look. She's like, I don't know about this guy.
I would say,
can you prove a historical event? Well, you think so? Okay. Prove to me right now. Prove to me absolute certainty, mathematical certainty, the elimination of all the possibilities.
I'm sorry.
That Abraham Lincoln existed.
Well, we have historical evidence.
What evidence do we have?
Eyewitnesses.
Yeah, they're
eyewitnesses. We have eyewitnesses alive today that saw Abraham Lincoln?
No, but we have the written word.
We have written documents.
Eyewitnesses.
Can those be altered? Yes. Okay, what else?
No, that's where I would go.
That's where you go?
Yeah.
We have pictures? Can pictures be altered?
No,
yes. Look at Loch Ness Monster. Okay. Okay. So can we prove historical events? Not according to that definition. No. And so it really hinges on what do we identify as proof. Right. Prove it to me. Can we prove a historical event with mathematical certainty? No. You cannot. Okay. Even if you have video footage, you have audio clips, those can all be altered.
But
even
eyewitness. I can prove the historical event that I was a witness to what I did.
Actually, you can't prove it because you could be a liar.
But I'm a liar.
You were there, but I wasn't there. Even if I was there, I could be hallucinating. You can't prove with mathematical certainty a historical event.
All your witnesses.
Not even 5 minutes ago. Even though this is being recorded, it could be altered. Even we all could be having a mass hallucination of some sort.
None of us are real.
Okay.
So you can't go home and prove right now.
So your point is that we can't prove anything.
We can't prove any historical event. And to understand that, okay, so we're not looking for proof. And when someone says, can you prove it to me, you have to be able to help them understand, well, I can't prove it, but you can't prove to me that Abraham Lincoln existed either. To help them understand that proof is not what they're looking for.
Right.
Because they don't live by the proof.
Okay.
Okay?
What about DNA?
What about DNA?
You could prove that someone was alive by DNA, right?
Do we have anything of Abraham Lincoln's that has DNA alive?
Right.
Right, but a month ago, somebody dies, and their DNA.
Can you actually prove that was
it? It could be mislabeled. I mean, seriously, there's every conceivable, if I can conceive of an error, then it's possible, right? And so it can be proven with mathematical certainty.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
It can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's what I'm getting you to. That proof is not what people are looking for. Even if they say it, well, can you prove it to me? They don't want proof. Okay? They don't live by proof. Okay? And that goes back to what are their barriers for rejecting the truth, and we'll get into that later. And so, if we can't prove historical events, what can we do? So, can we prove Christianity to be true? No. Scientific proof of the Abraham Lincoln is coming up short. If that bothers you, you can go find another universe to live in. Okay? Because we don't live by proof. Proof doesn't prove anything that we read in textbooks. The Constitution itself. We can't prove that anyone signed that. It could be a forgery. But we don't live that way, do we?
No.
We don't live with the what ifs. Okay, there's faith involved. So, but can we attain evidence beyond a reasonable doubt? And the answer is yes. So we have strong, good reasons to believe Abraham Lincoln existed. The fact that he's on a penny. I mean, that gives a strong reason to believe. We have historic pens now that could be altered, but it's not likely. And so what we're looking for is beyond a reasonable doubt. What is the best explanation for the events or for the nature of things? And that's what people live by. Although sometimes they're going to unfairly say, we prove it. And so you need to very fairly point them to the idea that, no, I can't prove it, but you can't prove to me that you existed yesterday. Okay. And bring them to understand the absurdity of mathematical certainty in instances that involve historical events. Okay? And so that's what we have to understand, is that people don't live by proof. They live beyond a reasonable doubt or the best explanation. If a particular belief cannot be proven due to the reality of other abilities, it requires simply the approach used by a detective. Okay? Because this idea that proof is the elimination of all other possibilities, well, if people did everything that way, they wouldn't get very far. If they had to eliminate every single other possibility before they can conclude this one, like if someone said, you know, I'm only going to eat the best French fries in the world. That means they would have to eat every single French fry ever made in every home, everywhere, to eliminate all other possibilities to conclude this is the world's best French fry. Right? So people don't live that way either. They don't live by eliminating all other stuff. They go with, beyond a reasonable doubt, what seems to be the best explanation when I gather the evidence. Okay? And so rather than a mathematician or a scientist, we have to be a detective in the way that we are discerning through these worldviews. Okay? The best possible explanation. What do we have the evidence to support? All right? Any questions?
Just a thought. Uh-huh. When we were talking about the justification scale, I didn't get it until this conversation happened. So injecting some of this kind of discussion back when we were
earlier.
Talking about, because I was thinking, well, you look at that scale and you think, what we convict to the point of death penalty on just a reasonable doubt, but then it's like, oh, well, because we don't have enough certainty on a death
right.
penalty. So that would have...
That would have been helpful earlier. Okay. That's good. Yeah. So that is starting to make sense, this justification scale. That's good. That's good. Kathy, you're okay with that? I think Abraham Lincoln did exist. I'm going to clarify that. And I think you were alive yesterday. Okay. Well, have a great day. We'll see some of you guys at Impact.